The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're going to get into quite a few different things on today's program. First up, though, I want to mention the Cardiff Pack coming up. It's kind of sneaking up on us. It's just a little over a month. Well, I guess exactly a month away. June 2nd, June 3rd. To this point, Cardiff, by the way, is, I guess it's in the south of Wales. Not too far from, I think, an hour and a half, 2 hours from the Edstone campus, and maybe an hour and a half, what would it be, west of London. So in any event, it's the first one that we're having in Wales after having one in England and then in Northern Ireland and then Scotland and now Wales. So that's June 2nd and 3rd, and to this point we have 70 registered for the first night. And then 55 for the second night. So it's looking like it won't be quite as big as London, but that it will be bigger than the packs that we had in Belfast and Glasgow. So that's coming up a month from now. Of course, we'll keep you up to date on the numbers, and hopefully, like we did at London, I think the plan this time, since it's a Sunday night, Monday night event, like it was in London back in October. Hopefully we can do a live broadcast from the hotel down there that Monday morning or Monday afternoon in between the two lectures. So and then we'll try to capture some of the sound from the event as well. Well, coming up on today's program in the second segment, if you listened to yesterday's show about just politicizing that history with respect to Thomas Jefferson. We'll continue on that same theme, not so much about Thomas Jefferson, but even more recent history. And, well, really, you see it's going on in real time, as you see, with these political circuses. Seems like we have one every week or two. I'll talk more about the Barr hearing in just a moment. But just even recent history, from a few years ago, or in the example we'll look at, from the early 1990s, not that long ago, and yet this effort, this movement, to try to revise it, to try to change the narrative, it's relentless. And you look at what's happening, well, just yesterday on Capitol Hill, and it's all about the spin. It's all about fighting to establish the narrative and to get as many people in America on your side. And of course, in the case of Barr, because he's upholding the law, it's all about smearing him, his opponents anyway. It's all about calling him names. He's a liar. He should resign. He's conflicted. And we've seen this before, just months ago, with Brett Kavanaugh, this mean-spirited assault. And they're going after him because he, as he has said earlier this year, he reveres the law. And these are lawless people, so many of them. And if you read between the lines of some of those responses he gave yesterday, the Attorney General, I guess, again, we'll have to wait and see if it actually does play out, but he certainly sounds like that he's going to be investigating and even prosecuting some of these lawless investigators that have gotten away with their lawless activities now for years. How did we get to this point, he asked yesterday. This is clip one.
You know, how did we get to the point here where the evidence is now that the president was falsely accused of colluding with the Russians and accused of being treasonous and accused of being a Russian agent. And the evidence now is that was without a basis. And 2 years of his administration, have been dominated by the allegations that have now been proven false. And, you know, to listen to some of the rhetoric, you would think that the Mueller report had found the opposite.
You listen to some of the coverage. You listen to the rhetoric. And it continues. People are trying to make the Mueller report say something that it did not say. The facts are there in 448 pages. But listen to the rhetoric. He still should go to jail. He still obstructed justice, clearly. How did we get to this point? Falsely accused of being treasonous. That came direct from John Brennan. That's about as high up as you can go in the previous administration. Certainly one of the higher ups. Accused of treason. And this narrative has dominated his presidency for 2 years. Who can deny that? That's all that we've heard. It's astounding that the economy and some other things have even had some positive developments there. When you consider this relentless assault, how did we get to this point? There was an exchange yesterday between Senator Cornyn, who asked about the Russian disinformation campaign. This is, I guess, one point that at least both sides can agree upon, that the Russians did interfere, that they did meddle. But so long as we're on the subject of Russian interference, what about the Steele dossier with all of those Russian sources? This is clip two.
Can we state with confidence that the Steele dossier was not part of the Russian disinformation campaign?
No, I can't state that with confidence, and that is one of the areas that I'm reviewing. I'm concerned about it, and I don't think it's entirely speculative.
William Barr is looking into it. Bob Mueller did not. We went through that Kim Strassel article a few days ago, or maybe it was last week, where she said, as long as, you know, after going through this long report, Bob Mueller's report, and all of this effort by the Russians to meddle, the disinformation campaign, she said, how could Bob Mueller ignore the Steele dossier with all of its Russian sources? How do we know that's not an attack from Russia to just turn the whole political system on its head? Look at what that document has done. Look at what it's caused. All of the spying, all of this illegal activity. Well, there was a senator asking. Maybe that was part of the Russian disinformation campaign. And then the attorney general saying, well, that's something I'm concerned about. And I'm looking into it. I'm reviewing it. There was another exchange. This is Senator Grassley about all of the leaks and what would be done about that. Clip three.
What are you doing to investigate unauthorized media contacts by the department and FBI officials during the Russian investigation?
We have multiple criminal leak investigations underway.
Multiple criminal leak investigations underway. Yesterday we talked about, of course, the fact that this letter that Bob Mueller wrote to the Attorney General, how that it leaked to the Washington Post and the New York Times. The night before this hearing, who leaked it? Well, you know it came from the Mueller camp, because it was leaked for the purpose of making the Attorney General look bad. It was leaked for the purpose of making that hearing yesterday as uncomfortable as possible for the new Attorney General. What about these leaks? Well, here's the AG, the current Attorney General. There's a new sheriff in Washington, D.C., that's for sure. And he's saying we have multiple criminal leaks or multiple criminal leak investigations underway. Listen to what else he said. Just a couple of shorter sound bites, clip seven.
What we have to be concerned about is, you know, a few people at the top getting it into their heads that they know better than the American people.
That's the Attorney General talking about the deep state. Those at the top, Comey, McCabe, Strzok, Page, Brennan, Clapper. The ones who thought they knew better than the American people. Here's another, clip 8.
And we have to stop using the criminal justice process as a political weapon.
Wow. That's quite a statement. Using the criminal justice process as a political weapon, weaponizing the Department of Justice, weaponizing the FBI, weaponizing the FISA process, going after your political opponents. You look at some of those statements yesterday. As the New York Post put it today, the references are unmistakable and the strongest sign yet that Barr suspects wrongdoing in very high places. It's also a sign that the worm is turning. It says here, Dems get the special counsel investigation they demanded and were able to play offense against Trump since 2016. Now the focus shifts to the other side of the story. The plot to steal the election and then undermine a duly elected president. Finally, the New York Post says, finally, we're getting to the history that matters most. Finally, the tables are turning. Finally, the hoax has been exposed. It's been fully exposed. It's there for all to see. And I know I keep going back to it, but the Saving America article temporarily from a year ago, the more and more we get into this, the more lawbreaking is revealed, tremendous amount of it. And my father in that article talked about how Barack Obama just loaded those agencies, those federal agencies, with bureaucrats that politicized the IRS, the Department of Justice, the FBI, the CIA. What was it my father said? Had Hillary Clinton been elected, the destructive trends that unfolded during the Obama presidency would have continued unchecked, and they surely would have intensified. It would have just continued unchecked. Well, now there's a new sheriff in town, and there's some people deep within the deep state, and some of them have already lost their jobs, but still, they've got to be concerned. Jim Comey, as he typically does, he hurriedly put together a response to the hearings yesterday, talking about how Donald Trump has eaten the soul of William Barr, of all things. And the New York Times, of course, right there to help him get his message out. His messages, which are increasingly more and more bizarre. They had the back and forth, this was earlier this year at a hearing, over the use of the word spying. You might have, you probably remember that when he said, "Well, yeah, it was going on," and then this was a big shock. Well, how could he say spying? It's a loaded term. They were saying, following that hearing, you can't say there was spying going on. And this came up again yesterday. It was the Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse who asked him about the use of this word, and the Attorney General pushing back, saying, "Well, I'm not going to not use it. If it happened, it happened." Listen to this exchange, clip 4.
You used the word spying,
mm-hmm,
about authorized DOJ investigative activities.
Are you talking about my testimony before,
yes,
the House Appropriations?
Yes.
Okay.
In the entirety of your previous career in the Department of Justice, including as Attorney General, have you ever referred to authorized department investigative activities officially or publicly as spying? I'm not asking for private conversation.
No, I'm not going to abjure the use of the word spying. I think You know, my first job was in CIA, and I don't think the word spying has any pejorative connotation at all. To me, the question is always whether or not it's authorized and adequately predicated spying. I think spying is a good English word that, in fact, doesn't have synonyms because it is the broadest word incorporating really all forms of covert intelligence collection. So I'm not going to back off the word spying, except I will say
when did you
I'm not suggesting any pejorative, and I use it frequently,
when
as do media. As do media.
He uses it frequently. It's a good English word. I agree with him on that. It's a good word to use. And then later on, White House said, well, it's not commonly used in your department. And he said, well, I use it. I use it commonly. That's the new sheriff who said previous to this hearing yesterday, he was spied upon. He was. That exchange yesterday, it made me think of, I think it was the point Mark Levin brought out a couple years ago. 2017, after the New York Times and all these other newspapers, remember, were talking about wiretapping, and I don't know how much they used the word spying, but wiretapping was there. It was in the headlines. And then Levin put all these articles together and said, look at what they're saying. Look at what they're admitting. They were spying on the Trump campaign. And then, of course, that triggered a furious response from the media saying, how can you say there's any kind of spying going on? And that continues. Arguing over the semantics. Well, should you really use this word? As if the media has never, ever used this word. Listen to this montage from Newsbusters, clip 5.
This memo delves into the secretive process under which the FBI obtains a warrant to essentially spy on Americans suspected of acting as a foreign agent.
This FISA warrant to spy on Carter Page is in October 2016.
The application to spy on Carter Page was 50 pages long.
When they spied on former Trump campaign advisor Carter Page.
The application to spy on Page was approved by the president's own deputy attorney general.
This spying on Carter Page.
And in fact, they didn't start spying on him until a month after he left the Trump campaign.
What if a judge would have decided to reject this warrant for spying on Page?
The spying on Carter Page.
Warrant applications to spy on.
FISA warrant to spy on.
A warrant to spy on.
Warrant to spy on former Trump campaign advisor Carter Page.
So anyone observing all of this can use the term, but not the attorney general. He's supposed. It's loaded. If he uses it, it's loaded. He's insinuating something. And, well, no, he isn't. It's a good English word, and it doesn't have synonyms because it's the broadest word incorporating really all forms of covert intelligence collections, to quote what he said yesterday. A lot of spying going on, and now it's being fully revealed, isn't it? Well, the war continues. Last night, the House took a vote. They were supposed to have their hearing today, and they voted to change the procedures to where even their aides, or I guess their assistants who are attorneys, could also ask questions. They desperately want to turn this into Watergate. They just want to keep it out there, turning it into a circus, a spectacle. And so the attorney general said last night, well, I'm not going to go then. If you're going to change the rules at the last hour, then I'm not showing up. He canceled his testimony for today. So here is someone that is pushing back, and it's worth spotlighting this because it's so rare. You see it with the president, but now you're seeing it with the attorney general, the new sheriff. My father, in writing about the lawlessness that preceded this current administration, he said in April of last year, a year ago, think about this. A law enforcement source fed information to the media, and then the law enforcement agencies used, he's talking about this echo chamber, and then the law enforcement agencies used the media's stories as proof of its claims. The media wrote stories about these claims, which law enforcement agencies used as even more proof to renew the warrant. He's talking about the spying on Carter Page. law enforcement, and the media formed an echo chamber. And you hear it over and again, the same talking points. It says, so the mainstream media has been complicit in this lawless plot. And that's why they're so upset. That's why they're furious. And the Democrats, too. Because they've been giving, as my father said in that article, they've been giving credibility to this nonsense for more than 2 years. And what a spectacular failure for the Mueller report to come out. 448 pages. There's no collusion. And we're not going to decide on obstruction. We'll let the AG do that. And he did. He did right away. He said there's no obstruction. There's no underlying crime. It's like he said in that first clip that we just played. How do you explain this? Falsely accused for 2 years colluding with the Russians. A treasonous agent. What has happened? And how can we clean this up? How can we stop this? That's the way that he's thinking. Judging by some of those comments he made yesterday, you go back to January. This was during his confirmation hearing when he basically said, look, I wasn't in hot pursuit of this job. But listen to him talk about his love and respect for law. This is clip 12.
I did not pursue this position, and when my name was first raised, I was reluctant to be considered and indeed proposed a number of alternative candidates. I'm 68 years old, partially retired, and nearing the end of a long legal career. My wife and I were looking forward to a peaceful and cherished time with our daughters and grandchildren, and I've had this job before. But ultimately, I agreed to serve because I believe strongly in public service. I revere the law. I love the Department of Justice and the dedicated professionals who serve there. And I believe that I can do a good job leading the department in these times.
It's refreshing. It's refreshing to hear someone high up in government talk about revering the law. We'll have hopefully come to that theme a little bit more at the end of the second segment, if we have time. But you don't hear that often today. I revere the law. And I didn't necessarily want this job, but I love the Department of Justice. He wanted to come back to restore order to the Department of Justice, to the FBI, to government, to these law enforcement agencies. Because lawlessness reigns supreme for years and years. The deep state. Corruption on a deep level. So deep, as my father said last year. Most people, still, they don't believe it. They just don't believe it. My father wrote, we're getting a hard look at just what the radical left is willing to do in order to seize power and to stay in power. They have no respect for the rule of law. And so that's why when you get to that hearing yesterday or the one with Kavanaugh a few months ago, that's why they're acting like children, spoiled brats. They didn't get their way. They lost out. And they're doing everything that they can to try to regain power, to seize power, and to stay in power. And there's a few standing up against it. And quite a few in America, of course, that see what's going on. Otherwise, Donald Trump wouldn't have gotten elected. There's a story at The Hill about CNN's ratings this past month, or I guess this was over the month of April. This is when the big Mueller report finally surfaced. No collusion. And CNN's been telling its viewers for 2 years, he's going to jail. His children, they're going to jail. Anyone close to him, they're going to jail. They're going to prison. They're going to be in orange jumpsuits. That's what a fall for CNN. I can remember in the early 1990s when that cable program, I think it was just following the first Iraq war, when they brought so many just riveting images from the Middle East right into the homes of average Americans. There were a lot of people across America back then that had respect for CNN and its coverage and their reporters. Reporters who in some ways were risking their lives. That's not CNN today. And it says here at The Hill, CNN's primetime ratings dropped a whopping 26% in April. 26%. They lost over a fourth of their audience. And that audience was already small compared to Fox. They're abandoning CNN in droves. MSNBC, same thing. It's down 14% in April compared to April of last year, just after 1 year. And their ratings, they're tanking. It says the sharp decrease for CNN marked its lowest rated month in total viewers since October of 2015. And then listen to this. In prime time, Fox News finished first with an average of 2.4 million viewers. This is for April. 2.4 million. MSNBC was second with an average of 1.66 million. And that's down from 1.93 million last April. And then CNN is third with 767,000 viewers. They're not even over a million. That's down from 1.04 million in April of last year. They're taking some hits. There's a lot of rebuke. It's coming from the president. It's coming now from the attorney general. It's coming from ratings agencies. And yet you'll see no repentance, no change of heart, no remorse, nor no humility. They'll just continue on attacking, slandering, telling lies, bringing accusations, demanding that he step down or resign or you've got to recuse yourself. You're conflicted. It just plays out over and again, and we'll look at that further in the next segment. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
In his testimony yesterday, the Attorney General, William Barr, he was answering questions brought to him by the Senate Judiciary Committee. And it was that same committee that grilled Brett Kavanaugh last fall. And the same committee, of course, different players back then, but it was the same Senate Judiciary Committee back in 1991 that grilled Clarence Thomas before his vote into the Supreme Court. And he barely made it in because right at the last moment, a woman came forward, Anita Hill, and accused him of sexual harassment. And this has come back into the news recently because Joe Biden was the one who chaired the Judiciary Committee. And there's quite a few Democrats today, especially now following the Me Too movement of the last few years, who have said that Biden was tough on Anita Hill, or he allowed too many tough questions. And keep in mind, he voted against Thomas's confirmation. He voted against it, and it very nearly derailed Clarence Thomas's opportunity to come into the Supreme Court. I forget what the exact vote was, but he just barely made it in. In any event, there's all these Democrats today saying, well, you should have been harder on Clarence Thomas. And really, really, you should apologize to Anita Hill, because if anyone comes forward with these scandalous accusations, if it's aimed at a Republican, well, then you have to believe the accuser. You have to believe the woman. This is what Joe Biden said last week about his apology to Anita Hill, clip six.
But I said privately what I've said publicly. I am sorry she was treated the way she was treated. I wish we could have figured out a better way to get this thing done. I did everything in my power to do what I thought was within the rules to be able to stop things.
It looks like it was a 52-48 vote, so he barely made it in. I think it was the slimmest majority of any Supreme Court justice. But that's him on The View last week, and he's saying, I have apologized to her. I said I'm sorry for the way that she was treated. But then, as he explained there, he did everything in his power to stop things. In other words, to stop Clarence Thomas from being confirmed. This is at The Federalist yesterday. It says here, while Biden initially insisted on The View that he had not personally treated Hill badly, he has since backpedaled, given Hill's refusal to accept his soft apology and blowback from the left. By Monday, Biden was ready to do his his full mea culpa, telling a Pittsburgh town hall audience he took responsibility for her purportedly unfair treatment. So what you heard was from The View last week, and he's since had to come out full force this week, saying that he takes responsibility for her supposed unfair treatment. Listen to this. It says, but Hill's story, Anita Hill's story, was hardly incontestable. Her testimony to the committee was markedly different and more salacious than what she had given to the FBI just days earlier. She changed key points of her narrative before and after lunch recess. This is 1991. This is not quite 30 years ago, but she changed her story over the course of lunch. It says, after the date she claimed harassment had taken place, Hill followed Thomas to another office. In other words, he went to another job and she followed him over there. She wanted to keep working for him. Even after she had been supposedly, repeatedly sexually harassed. It says colleagues asserted that she had praised Thomas's nomination before accusing him. An office mate whom Hill denied knowing until she was forced to acknowledge familiarity under questioning told the New York Times that the allegations were the result of Hill's unrequited sexual pursuit of Thomas, not the other way around. Yet today, the allegation that Thomas harassed Hill is treated as fact by the majority of mainstream media outlets and she is hailed as the godmother of the Me Too movement. Questioning her story, as Biden's capitulation shows clearly, is no longer an option in polite company. You can't question her story. That's not even an option. She must be believed. She accused a conservative, after all. And so his reputation, his life, it should be destroyed. Never mind the past 20-some years, 27, 28 years, and Judge Thomas's impeccable record at the Supreme Court. It says here, despite Americans' low opinion of the media, a repeatedly advanced narrative can still take its toll. When Hill first testified in 1991, almost 60% of those listening believed Judge Thomas. That's right. A strong majority. They believe Clarence Thomas. But you know what happened? Well, Hollywood. Hollywood got involved, and you had the little TV shows or movies here and there. The narrative, you see, it's continually reworked. Here we are now in 2019, and Joe Biden, he's got to apologize. It's his fault. As the chairman of that Judiciary Committee, he should have stopped it. He should have stopped Anita Hill from even being questioned, because her story is to be believed. Judge Thomas gave one of the strongest responses, probably in Capitol Hill history, in his own defense. Here's what he said in October 1991, clip 9.
Senator, I would like to start by saying unequivocally, uncategorically, that I deny each and every single allegation against me today that suggested in any way that I had conversations of a sexual nature or about pornographic material with Anita Hill, that I ever attempted to date her, that I ever had any personal sexual interest in her, or that I in any way ever harassed her. A second, and I think more important point, I think that this today is a travesty. I think that it is disgusting. I think that this hearing should never occur in America. This is a case in which this sleaze, this dirt, was searched for by staffers of members of this committee, was then leaked to the media, and this committee and this body validated it and displayed it at prime time over our entire nation. How would any member on this committee, any person in this room, or any person in this country would like sleaze said about him or her in this fashion, or this dirt dredged up and this gossip and these lies displayed in this manner? How would any person like it? The Supreme Court is not worth it. No job is worth it. I'm not here for that. I'm here for my name, my family, my life, and my integrity.
By that point, he didn't even care about the job. He was just there to tell the truth. He was just there to defend his integrity, his family name. Did you hear what he described there as far as how this came about? The committee. Witnesses who said she was excited for his appointment to the Supreme Court. And then out came this story. Judge Thomas said the Judiciary Committee was there digging up the dirt behind the scenes and then leaking it. Does any of this sound familiar? Leaking it to the news media. And then the reports are out, and then the committee running with that. Here's the echo chamber. The committee bringing it out in front of the public and validating it at Capitol Hill. And here's Clarence Thomas, just mercilessly slandered in front of America. And at that time, a lot of America didn't buy it. But you just have to give it some time. Satan keeps chipping away. One Hollywood movie here, one tell-all book here. And of course, you've already got the media and the Democrats on board with it. Today, Joe Biden, he owes Anita Hill an apology. So say many Democrats. In fact, like the Federalist brings out, he owes Judge Thomas an apology. He owes Clarence Thomas an apology. How would he like it? How would any of us like it to be slandered and lied about in this way? To be destroyed. Your reputation is destroyed. It's like the Federalist says, forever and ever, at least with half the country, there's going to be an asterisk next to Judge Thomas's name as a Supreme Court justice. Well, you go back to 1991 when a large majority of Americans believed him. No wonder. When you listen to what he said, powerful, powerful words, and a strong warning for America as well. Listen to clip 10 here.
I think something is dreadfully wrong with this country when any person in this free country would be subjected to this. This is not a closed room. There was an FBI investigation. This is not an opportunity to talk about difficult matters privately or in a closed environment. This is a circus. It's a national disgrace.
Something's dreadfully wrong with the country, he said. What a disgrace. A national disgrace. Well, right after he said that, he momentarily leaned back in his chair as if he was finished, and then leaned forward again toward the microphone for one final statement. Clip 11.
And from my standpoint, as a black American, as far as I'm concerned, it is a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves, to do for themselves, to have different ideas. And it is a message that unless you kowtow to an old order, this is what will happen to you. You will be lynched, destroyed, caricatured by a committee of the U.S. Senate rather than hung from a tree.
Wow. Lynched by a committee of the U.S. Senate. That's Judge Clarence Thomas at the hearing in October 1991. 60% of America, following that hearing, believed him. What would it be today? The Federalist says Justice Thomas has received no Hollywood invitations to tell his side of the story, quite unlike Anita Hill, I'll add. For almost 30 years, he has had to endure the permanent stain that the media circus has left on his good name. And when his term as justice is recorded in the history books, it will always bear an asterisk on one side of the aisle. It's a fate that likely awaits Justice Brett Kavanaugh as well. It says further on, sexual crimes perpetuated against women are an intolerable injustice, but so is smearing an innocent man's name in perpetuity. It says the shift in public opinion over allegations fairly perceived as dubious at the time is yet another hard reminder of what's at stake in the battle over diminishing standards of proof. The shift. How is it we see such a dramatic shift in the public opinion over allegations? Whether it's with Thomas Jefferson in 1802 or Clarence Thomas in 1991, and then we come to 2019 and we're so advanced, so educated, so scholarly. We know so much more than our forebears. And the truth, as we keep pointing out over and again, the truth is what is cast to the ground. The truth, over and again, is the first casualty. There was an op-ed piece at the Washington Post just the other day, and it was by a history teacher, talking about the alarming rise of white power violence. There's commentators, there's evidently history teachers too, who are out there saying this is really spreading like a wildfire, driven by racism. And of course, there is a lot of racial hatred from all sides. But the way that this individual, this history teacher, the way that he talks about history, it's astounding. And this is in the Washington Post. Didn't we, as he says in this column, didn't we fight against the spread of white supremacy? Didn't we fight against the fascist symbols of swastikas and such back in World War II? Didn't we win that war? Well, he says, not exactly, because while Allied countries opposed the Nazis and Allied troops defeated them, the leaders of the United States and Britain rarely attacked the core tenet of Nazism, the belief in a master race. So we never did battle that. The belief, the idea, the ideology of a master race, of all things. He says, in my World War II class recently, I had my students pore through the speeches and letters of British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. You know where this is going. From the years around the war start in 1939, searching for his basis for opposing the Nazis. They found Churchill wanted to stand up to the Nazis' expansionism, fight their anti-democracy posture, and resist what he called, but largely left undefined, their anti-Christianity. What he did not do, however, was call for the destruction of the essence of Nazism, race supremacy. So Churchill was a racist. That's what he's getting at here. And others have said this before him. But he's a history teacher. He did not call for the destruction of race supremacy. And so he brings this lesson. And he's teaching this lesson to history students. He's bringing it straight to today. It says, after Charlottesville 2, social media echoed with variations of the line, my grandpa didn't fight the Nazis only for them to return. And it's possible that a good many of our grandfathers might have fought the Nazis expressly to oppose their race supremacy. But it's worth putting this plainly. The Allied leadership did not fight the war over fascist race nationalism. It says that was the historical path not taken. And in his view, well, we're still paying for it today. And that's why we see the spread of right-wing violence. That's in history classes in the United States. There was a story at the American Institute for Economic Research about the left-wing professors on today's campuses. It says the college professors have long positioned themselves to the political left of the American public. The progressive skew in higher education used to be a stable plurality, though. But beginning with the earliest survey data or it talks about what it was in the 60s and 70s. It was always like 43% or so college professors that saw themselves as liberal, and then the rest was made up of moderate or conservative. Then something changed around the year 2001. 2001, here again, go back to what we talked about yesterday. A lot of this is just a fairly recent phenomena. It says, then something changed around the year 2001. The percentage of faculty who identify with the political left began to skyrocket. In the course of under 15 years, left-leaning faculty rose to an outright majority of 60% of the professoriate. 60%. And then it talks about the fields or the departments that they dominate. The humanities, the social sciences, history departments, English professors, those kinds of things. And then we wonder why our children are turning, or why our reporters, our journalists, are graduating from Columbia University and then going on the attack against traditional values, anything traditional. My father had a section in the Ezekiel booklet about Satan's efforts to destroy history or to rewrite history. We're going to have our work cut out for us. As it says there in Acts 3, when the restitution of all things happen, we're going to have to restore truth to this world. He says here, and you can see why, because Satan's the god of this world. 2 Corinthians 4:4. My father writes, Satan is very hostile to history and works extremely hard to destroy it. He wants Israel to forget its history. He wants us to forget our history. He wants us to rewrite it. He wants it to be revised. It says, most of all, he's working to destroy his own history. Satan wants to revise his history as well. He wants to blot it out. And he's been so successful in doing it. But as my father brings out in that same booklet, when you forget your history, you lose perspective. You don't really know what's happening. You can't grasp the significance of these current events. You get lost in the present. We've got to either learn the lessons of history or we're condemned to repeat it. Don't underestimate the power of the devil, he said. Don't underestimate it. Look at where we are today. What did the Attorney General say yesterday? How did we get to this point? How could this have happened? How could this have gone on for 2 years? A president of the United States for 2 years, falsely accused, spied upon, accused for being a treasonous agent. Well, it's happening because there's no truth in the land. Everyone's doing what seems right in his own eyes. And I tell you, again, because of maybe yesterday's show and then today's, it really does underscore the importance of 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 21. Short little verse, memory verse. The Apostle Paul saying, prove all things, prove it. And then hold on to it. You've got to hang on to the truth. Remember those words. Remember how this scandalous allegation got started with Thomas Jefferson. Or with Clarence Thomas. Go back and look at the record. Consider all the contradictions. Consider the motives of these people coming forward with all of this gossip. That's all that it amounts to. And consider the fact. Add to that the spiritual dimension. Revelation 12, as we covered yesterday. The fact that Satan the devil, he is the accuser of the brethren. He's the father of lies, John 8:44. Look at what's happened in God's church. I touched on this yesterday. We've seen this history play out in God's church, in spiritual Israel, and then you see it And then you see it happening in your own nations. And you have all of these examples. Robert Bork in 1987, Clarence Thomas in 1991, Brett Kavanaugh last year, Donald Trump, now William Barr. Prove the truth. And then hold on to it. Don't forget the last half of that verse for 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 21. We've got to prove all things. And when we accept it as truth, then the objective is to hold fast to it. Hang on to it. Hang on to God's truth. And don't let go. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.